Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
40 Minutes of Hell, the title of Russ Bradbird's book about basketball coach Nolan Richardson, refers to what Coach Richardson used to encourage his teams to impose on the opposition. As the head coach at the University of Arkansas, Richardson led his team to the national championship in 1994. As one of the first black men to coach a major sport at a predominantly white university, Richardson used the podium that came with his position to remind everyone who would listen that more black men and women should have opportunities like the one he had earned. Russ Bradbird joins me now from KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where he is an assistant professor. Russ, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. It's good to be back.
And we're also joined on the phone by Nolan Richardson. Coach, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you also. I'm very happy to be a part of it.
And if things don't work out in coaching, boy, do you have a radio voice.
More of a preacher, man. I'm thinking about going into that a little bit, too.
Excellent, excellent. Russ, you served as an assistant basketball coach at the Division I level for 14 years. What was it about your experience in that realm that eventually led you to think it would be a good idea to write a book about Nolan Richardson?
Well, like a lot of people, I saw that press conference that happened in 2002 in a room full of an all-white media at a time when it was supposed to be just another press conference before the game against Mississippi State. Coach Richardson talked about race and discrimination for about 40 minutes. And I thought, how did it happen that a guy goes from winning the national championship in 1994, a historic championship, to being fired and sort of crash landing a few years later? But also, you know, at that time it was 2002. I also noticed that nearly everyone from the newspapers to television condemned Nolan Richardson and basically said that he'd gotten what he deserved. And I thought, there must be more to the story than this. It can't possibly be this simple.
Coach Richardson, when you learned about this project, did you immediately think, well, yeah, book about me, that would be fine?
Well, see, I'd been approached many times about a book being written about me over the years, and I just didn't think it was the time for me to really have a book written. I was thinking about an autobiography myself doing it. I wanted someone, to be honest with you, that lived in my area. I mean, someone that knew some of my background, knew some of the people who knew who I really was. I mean, being a coach, they see what the finished product is on the floor. They don't know what's behind all the doors and behind the scenes and what makes a person or a coach. And Russ was a coach at one time, so therefore I thought he would be able to give a fair, clean picture of it. Not everything that he wrote in the book glorifies me, and so there were some things that I really didn't particularly like, but that's the reality of the book.
There is a good deal of history in this book, and not just the history of how Nolan Richardson made it to the top of the college basketball world from very difficult childhood circumstances in the Segundo Barrio section of El Paso. Russ, you include here the Tulsa race riot of 1921 and accounts of various confrontations between Arkansas authorities and the U.S. National Guard over civil rights. To what extent is that historical background necessary to Nolan Richardson's story?
I think we'd all agree that if we never talk about race and never talk about what happened in the past, that's not the answer. And neither do we need to talk about it every 5 minutes. But I think with Nolan Richardson, he wants to point out injustices of the past. And I think he's sort of the historical link. He wants us to remember guys like Clarence Big House Gaines and John McClendon, great coaches at the historically black colleges who never got a chance. Americans were cheated out of the greatest college games of all time. We never got to see Big House Gaines against Dean Smith or John McClendon against John Wooden for the NCAA championship. And so I feel that Nolan Richardson is the bridge to that history.
But you also write at one point in the book, at several points, that a lot of the people who have known Nolan Richardson, even lots of his friends, regard him as a man who always has had a chip on his shoulder and never forgets a slight, real or perceived. I'm paraphrasing here. Is that characterization accurate?
I think any kid who grows up in Segundo Barrio, he grew up in the poorest neighborhood in the most isolated city in America. And I think kids who grow up in that neighborhood have this sort of it's us against the world kind of feeling. The truth is, Bill, that Nolan Richardson's rise to the top of college basketball was the greatest against all odds struggle of any coach who's ever won the national title. No one had the deck stacked against him like Nolan Richardson did. But I think that's what fueled him as a coach. I think the first guy to break through could not have been someone who got along with everybody and was nice to everyone and never talked about race. I think what Nolan Richardson and Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown and Bill Russell, guys like that, have done is they've made it possible for Tiger Woods never to talk about race and made it possible for Michael Jordan never to talk about race. The guys who broke through had to be brash and confident, and I think that's precisely who he is.
Coach, I have to give you a chance to refute the idea that you never forgot a slight, real or perceived.
I personally never thought I carried a chip on my shoulder. I was raised by a grandmother who taught me more than in my upbringing than any books. Mm-hmm. She would always talk to me about, you're going to have a chance in life, but you may have only one chance. And so when you get that chance, son, you got to take advantage of that chance. And so when you grow up and you're not allowed to sleep in the same hotel with your teammates, or you're not allowed to eat in the same restaurant with your teammates, and you live across the tracks when you're on the road because you can't stay in a hotel, you take that, and as she would say, you let your bat, you let your shooting, or you let your catching passes do the talking for you. And remember that, and she was a big Jackie Robinson fan. Mm-hmm. Jackie had to do those things in order for us to have a chance. You're always going to be judged in a group. You're not going to be judged individually. So if you don't do good, your kids will suffer. Mm-hmm. And I thought when she said my kids, I mean, I was a little boy. She meant the African-American kids. If I did bad, then there's no one to come to take that place or pave that road. So you're not only playing for you or in your family. You're playing for a lot of families, son. So, you know, I had that kind of a deal going with me. When I coached in high school and got a job, it wasn't about just Nolan. You know, so it looked like I had a tremendous anger or chip on my shoulder. And then my voice, you just mentioned that. If I got up and talked the way I'm talking to you, some people think I'm angry, and I said to me, I can't help it because I'm 6'3", 230, and have a voice like this. I mean, you know, every time I said, hey, that don't mean I'm angry. That's just my voice, you know. And sometimes the voice was good because when I said hey to my players, they knew what hey mean. Let's go.
You had the reputation of a man who always inspired his players by telling them that nobody else respected them. All the other college coaches had ignored them, had not recruited them. I understand that as a motivational tool, but how did you use that strategy when your teams were ranked number one, number two, among the best in the whole country?
You know, I don't think I told my teams all the time that they were not wanted. Matter of fact, I encouraged them in many different ways. Old Granny would always say, there's more than one way to skin a cat. So I skinned that cat in as many different ways. If we had the cat that I needed to say, hey, do I kick this one or do I pat this one? Or you're up on the top. How long do you think that you're going to be on the top? Everybody is after you on the top. I said, this is just like a basketball coach. It's not but one step from the outhouse to the penthouse. Or one step below from the penthouse, you in the outhouse.
Everyone coaching a revenue sport needs to win or he'll lose his job. But, Russ, you indicate in 40 Minutes of Hell that Nolan Richardson was close to losing his job several times even when his teams were winning. This was partly because of the ongoing power struggle between Arkansas athletic director Frank Broyles and Coach Richardson. But was there more to it than that?
I think the big question, Bill, is what kind of success could Nolan Richardson have? You know, he went to three different Final Fours and won the national championship in 1994. But I'll always wonder what kind of success he would have had if he felt like his athletic director was behind him. Mm-hmm. Some of it was inevitable. Here's a guy, you know, in Frank Broyles from the Old South, who'd never coached against a black coach, had never played against a black player himself in his career. And then along comes Nolan Richardson, who'd played for Don Haskins, a guy who changed the world, won a socially significant national championship. And these guys are headed for trouble.
Coach, some of the press conferences and interviews that Russ cites in this book make it sound as if you had some pretty self-destructive episodes. In 1995, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette reported that you called the team's fans names that I can't repeat in this context. And at a press conference shortly before you were fired that we've already spoken about, you indicated that whether your players graduated or not wasn't your responsibility. It was a curious thing for you to say, since you had really encouraged players over the course of your career to go to school. Do you regret those occasions?
If you talk to my players, I'd explain to them, look, son, I am the first kid in my entire family ever graduate from high school. High school. I'd never forget my grandmother, how happy and proud she was of me getting just a high school education. And then when I finished college, oh, that was the greatest moment. You know, we turned down 10 or 15,000 of the Houston Astros the year before. She would not sign it so I could get an education and a degree. I preached that morning, noon, and night. So my term was in a school, in a university. The math teacher's not held responsible. The English teacher's not held responsible. Why does a coach have to be responsible for an education? Now, I did not graduate because Coach Haskins got me to graduate. I graduated because that's what I wanted. And he gave us the tools to get it. So my job at this institution is to give the tools. I'll get you up in the morning. I'll run you. I'll suspend you. I'll do whatever it takes. But the ultimate decision has got to be you, your family, and all of us. They didn't write that. All of us are responsible for a young man's education.
Of course, the counter argument about a coach's responsibility would be, hey, you recruited these young men to come play basketball for you. Aren't you responsible if some of them aren't really capable of doing the work here and are here under kind of a false pretext?
Every youngster that I took at the university does have a chance to get an education. And the sad part about it is, or the good part about it is, it doesn't have to be in a four-year period. These youngsters who have preconceived ideas about playing in the NBA, and some of them have families already, and some of them, I know, are not going to stay directly 4 or 5 years to the schooling. They're going to go overseas. They're going to go wherever they can to make some money to have a life. Now, once those days are over, they can come back to school, and a lot of them have done that. I went back to school. I went to trial with the San Diego Chargers, quit school, went and tried it, didn't make it, went back and got my degree. Mm-hmm. And I always tell my players that. The window of opportunity is the most important thing. If you got a window to make X number of dollars, you better use that window, because education is forever if you want it. You can get an education. If you do the right things, you can buy your own education. You don't have to have a scholarship.
Russ, as you point out in 40 Minutes of Hell, at least in terms of numbers, times have changed for the better since Nolan Richardson was one of a very small number of black head coaches at Division I schools. To what extent is he responsible for the progress?
Well, I think between John Thompson and John Cheney and Nolan Richardson, they're totally responsible. And it wasn't just that those three guys won in a big way and were confident and brash and talked about race and opportunity, but they also got the black coaches organized. The Black Coaches Association became a major force in the hiring practices in college basketball, and that was precisely because the three guys at the top of the letterhead were Nolan Richardson, John Thompson, and John Cheney. Football coaches have never been organized in the same way. They need a Nolan Richardson or a John Thompson, not just to win and win big, but to get the other coaches organized.
Coach, do you think Arkansas, as part of your legacy perhaps, gets the respect that the program deserves when they talk about great basketball programs now, the Dukes and UCLAs of the world?
You know, Arkansas, I would say, was a 50-50 in the state, where you would have 50% of the fans with basketballers and 50% of football. Mm-hmm. I don't see that today. No, I think it's pretty much football and basketball has come on rough times. You know, when you talk to people that are a little bit older about basketball, Arkansas is mentioned quite a bit. And, of course, our style of play was a lot different than most styles. I see more of the style that I thought we played. And going back to John McClendon, who was a fast break guy, it disappeared because it became rat ball or the N-word ball or alley ball or, you know, they called it everything. And now it's fast break and up tempo. They got nice names for it, you know. So I understand. I understand how the evolution of the game has changed. So I remember playing in New York with Tulsa team, and we stepped out of bounds and threw a long touchdown pass, and Digger was the announcer, and the first thing he said, see what I mean? It doesn't take them long to shoot the ball. I said, well, hell, it's a layup. What do you want me to do? So, you know, it depends on who you're listening to, you know, about the best teams in the country.
Russ Bradbird is the author of 40 Minutes of Hell, The Extraordinary Life of Nolan Richardson, published by HarperCollins. Russ, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And Nolan Richardson, the subject of the book, has coached the national basketball teams of Panama and Mexico since leaving the University of Arkansas. He will next be on the sideline for the WNBA's Tulsa Shock. Coach, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much, Bill.
My conversation with Russ Bradbird and Nolan Richardson will be featured on this week's program. Courtesy of Only a Game's Karen Given, we'll also have the story of an entirely different sort of sports program, one that has been established to encourage teenagers who've suffered abuse and neglect and who are trying to learn via teamwork and athletic competition skills they've never had the opportunity to acquire. We will not neglect the Olympics. Of course, I'll be speaking once again with our guy in Vancouver, John Powers of the Boston Globe, and Dave Silk, one of the heroes of the 1980 U.S. ice hockey team, will put the alleged miracle on ice in a context that may surprise you. We'll also look ahead to the next Winter Olympics, which will be held in Sochi, Russia, 4 years hence. So join us, and remember you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.